Hey, listeners, before we get to our regular show, I have an exciting announcement about our next live show, Together for the Rant, The Last Laugh. Now, this doesn't mean it's our last live show ever. It means that it is connected to the last Together for the Gospel conference ever. Thus, The Last Laugh. It will be Monday, April 18th at 7 p.m. at Sojourn New Albany, Sojourn Church, New Albany, Indiana. Now, you might be thinking, T4G is in Louisville. Indiana's a different state. Those don't sound very close together. In reality, New Albany is about a 10-minute drive from where T4G takes place, just across the river there, so very close by. Again, Monday, April 18th, 7 p.m., we will have two different ticket options. We have a standard $20 ticket option. That just means you get to attend and enjoy two live recordings and a Q&A and hanging out with us. Or we have a $45 premium ticket option, which there's a limited quantity of these, up to 50, that will include an exclusive Last Laugh t-shirt and some other goodies designed by our good friend Josh Byers, who does all of our swag and all of our merch for us. So again, $20 or $45, including a t-shirt, some stickers, other goodies. You can find all of this at thehappyrant.com. It's at thehappyrant.com. Look for the live show link. You can buy your tickets there. You can select premium or standard. We would love to see you Monday, April 18th, 7 p.m. for Together for the Rant, The Last Laugh. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Happy Rant. Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Ron, here's kind of the setup of the show. So there's three of us here. Pipe brings a topic or two. And we just talk about it for like 30, 35 minutes. I know it's been a while since you've been in the studio.
Yeah, so I appreciate you guys having me on the show.
Yeah, you're in a foreign place right now. You're in a place that doesn't feel quite right.
It's been a dream to be on with you guys.
Hoping
this like turns into bigger things. Maybe a book.
No, listen.
Maybe another podcast.
Yeah. And
dreaming big, guys. Dreaming big.
Pipe and I are just grateful for you making the time this morning. So thanks for being with us.
Anytime, guys.
If you want to tell
us. I'm available anytime. And by that, I mean hardly ever.
Tell us about yourself. Tell us about your new book, you know.
Yeah, well, I have a new book that I actually named after this podcast.
I love it.
And I hope that was okay. Mm-hmm. But I really was taken in by the name that this guy named Stephen Altrogi came up with. And I thought, you know what? I bet I could get a deal and write a book based on the podcast, even though I'm not on it, but I feel like I have something to contribute to it. And I got a deal, and that thing's dropping like in August. So, I mentioned you guys in the book, just so you know, your names are on it. And I even blurb about you a little bit. So mm-hmm. I wanted to come on just to give you a heads up that's coming out on Harvest House.
Harvest House.
So, you guys will probably get a little bit of cash out of it on the back end, and I hope that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. You guys are going to get a little bit of cash. You're going to do a lot of work. And at the end of the day, we will have a book.
Just benefits mostly everybody. It's good for everybody.
Yeah. Mostly it's puffing up my ego, and I get to say that I'm humbled now because I'm actually prideful. So,
yeah, you guys, honestly, I'm so humbled to have a book come out. You know what? I'm also so prideful to have a book come out. And
what if you just started saying that? Like, dude, guys, I feel so prideful.
Dude, what if you just started
on this podcast?
Yeah, what if you just started doing like completely honest podcast and radio show appearances? Guys, I just want to say I'm so inconvenienced to be here. It is such.
I'm not at all happy to be on with you today.
Yeah. I'm so annoyed to be doing this right now. I just want you to know that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's. I mean, honestly, to be honest, I'm grateful. Because I'd rather be doing anything else but this right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm grateful to not be on with you guys talking about things that I maybe care less about than anything else in the world, including all of the things I could care more or less about than anything else in the world. Does that drop it low enough?
Yeah, that's good. I've got like 75 other things I need to be doing,
This is wasting a lot of my time, and I'm super bummed about it.
Yeah, exactly.
So can we just hurry and like finish this?
Yeah, I'm going to start the day stressed as a result of doing this. So, that's great.
Mostly though, guys, I'm so glad for the the amount of preparation you didn't put into this, the questions that you didn't at all prepare for, the fact that you didn't read my book before this interview at all, and you're just basically thumbing through the table of contents and chapter headings and just winging it right now. So,
well, Pipe, I feel so
not honored by that, and it's going to be a joy to get off this.
You podcast. Shouldn't feel honored about it, because Ted and I approximately did zero prep to your prep that you did only that probably 2% worth of prep on. So, I would be furious if I was you right now, Pipe. I would just get off. I would jump off right now if I was you. That's what I would.
But I'm glad that you're going to ask me questions that I wrote entire chapters about in the book, so that I can just recap what I already wrote. That way people don't have to buy the thing that we're promoing. So this is going to go so well. It's going to go great.
Well, you know,
the word superfluous comes up a lot when I'm thinking about the value of everything that we're doing.
You know what I am actually earnestly happy about, though? We got over that cover design hump. We got over the blurb deal. You know, there were a few significant.
It's been a lot of getting over things.
Yeah, it's been a lot of getting over things.
It's basically been like writing a book for three people is like one big tall mountain followed up by like 75 tinier mountains.
Dude, what do authors say? It's like having a baby. You know, it's like having a baby with the two of you guys.
Yeah, what happens when three people have a book baby, but it's just one baby?
Hey,
I feel like this metaphor.
You know what? Normalize that though in the culture.
Like, we're having
I'm triples. Fine with three people having a baby. Triples. And if you're not, you're the worst.
It's like co-parenting. Is that what we're doing here?
That's right. And it's a fine model.
I think what we're doing, boys, is what I blurbed on, which is hashtag mwriting.
We don't really need to
release books. We just need to tell people that we're hashtag mwriting, and that's good. Yeah. We're good.
Hey,
I also think we should stop referring to writing of books. That's very dehumanizing. We should refer to gestating books.
Right.
I think that works better.
Yeah, I felt triggered when I even saying mwriting, I should change it to hashtag mgestating.
Baby, I wanna stay on that for a minute though. Go a minute on hashtag mwriting. Like, what's the energy there? Like if someone hashtags that, what are they looking for from the universe? Like likes or good jobs or tell me about your project or what are they looking for?
I mean, I think you just nailed it. Yeah. Okay. I think it's like, give me some effort, like give me some encouragement that all of this time I'm spending on this is not going to be in vain.
Oh, whoa. All of this time I'm tweeting about spending, but not actually not spending.
Right. You can't be writing while you're tweeting about writing, correct? You can't be hashtag mwriting while you're writing simultaneously.
Dude, so true. Not to get like too thinky about it, but there was a time when, like,
far be it from us to get too thinky.
that's true. There was a time when, like, one of the sexy things about writing was the solitary nature of it, right? So the whole idea of I'm doing this by myself, I'm an artist, I'm alone. But, like, I feel like the hashtag am writing thing, and just so kind of nakedly looking for affirmation for not even the finished product, but like the process. So it's like you're not even tweeting out like the open box of books on the front porch or whatever. You just want affirmation for the process. I feel like,
yeah, for,
like J.D. Salinger would have never done that. You know what I mean?
No, J.D. Salinger, just all of a sudden you knew he had a book out and it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Like that dude's been working on that thing for like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I can't wait.
Right.
And now it's, yeah, now it's more like we've lost our sense of cool. You know, I mean, we're in a.
Yeah.
In a
so I think.
Cool.
I want to stay on that too. That's really interesting. So I think a large part of cool, if we're trying to define what that is restraint. And if you're talking about something all the time, it's the opposite of restraint. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and 100%. And the reason why we can never go back to coolness in that area is because there was a time when self-promo was the epitome of uncoolness.
Yeah.
But that's, we have to do that now. Like, we're in a self-promo world. So you're always saying, you're basically saying hashtag mwriting.
Yeah.
For everything that you do, because you have to sort of self promo. So we just kind of eliminated cool, you know.
I think Ronnie is totally onto something there. But the idea of like the am writing thing is basically you are branding yourself a writer. Like self promo is the constant.
Mm-hmm.
The product is periodic.
Yeah.
Whereas like I have to constantly be the brand. And so that whole like am the other piece of it though, and I would love to get your guys' thoughts on this is that it seems like more and more people want to write, quote unquote, in community, you know, get people's input, which is ironically, after co-authoring a book with you two fine gentlemen, is the worst thing in the world for me as a writer. I don't want anybody to speak into what I'm writing until I'm done.
Yeah, totally. No, I think that's a, like, I don't know if it's generational or what, but again, like in 25-year-old me's mind's eye of thinking about what was cool about being a writer, doing it like in community was anathema. That just sounds horrible. Like, group work in college was horrible. Writing, anything collaborative, like
you just don't think of like being artistic. You don't do that, and you don't think of it as being sort of a collaborative. Like, Rembrandt's not just sitting there with his homeboys like painting.
Like, hey, what do you guys think of this tree? You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's it could be one of the few things that the three of us really deeply have in common is, like, we basically wrote a book uncollaboratively,
in a weird way. And in that, it was a triumph, you know? Like,
yeah.
I loved how we didn't collaborate at all on the book that we wrote together.
Collaboratively. Man, I wish we would have put something like that on the back spread.
Right? Yeah, I know. Man, let's go back to that, the copywriter.
The most uncollaborative co-author experience.
I mean, seriously. But I also think, too, man, is, you know, Pipe has said this a few times, and again, I don't know about you, T. I think maybe you're less like this. I'm not sure, you tell me, but like, I know both Piper and I, we hate research.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I really hate it. Writing to me is more stream of consciousness than anything. I just want to write, you know? And so I don't want to be looking at writing in order to be able to write. I just want to write. Right. Yeah. And so, and I don't know about you, T, but like, man, when you start getting into this, hey, you know, so I'm just thinking about a few different things here. Could you guys maybe answer a couple of questions? Because I'm on this particular chapter and I need just to get, it's like, oh my God, I just, you know what? I'm not even going to write the book now. You know, like, I don't even, like, I just feel like I want to give up the entire project if I got to get into those kinds of like detail oriented things.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, what Pipe, to Pipe's point a minute ago, it's so true. It's like, it's almost like a form of procrastination, right? Like, dude, just write the thing. Just
I know it. Dude, so do you guys think that, like, hashtag am writing and wanting to write, quote unquote, in community, do you think that's a function of just how, like, achingly lonely people are in general? And they're the kind of, the calculus is, I'm doing writing. This is a thing I want to be doing. I'm achingly lonely, so I'm going to seek out the community through that. Whereas I think for us, like, really the only place I want to be, quote, in community is in my church and my friendships. And otherwise, like, I just want to do my job, you know, or do my writing or do my football or whatever. I think it's
that, and I think it's insecurity. I think people need validation that their writing doesn't suck. Mm-hmm. When in reality, it probably does. But and people are too nice to say so, because it's we live in an era where you can tell people they suck anonymously on social media, but you cannot tell them in community. So I think there's a sense of validation that people are looking for, that their writing is, like, you're doing a good thing. You're really getting it. Good job. When in history, the greatest writing triumphs in history have not been validated. Many of them haven't even been validated after publication for a significant amount of time before they sort of found their way into the consciousness or the awareness, or they struck a chord with a different generation or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's a weird thing where people are like, they're writing like they're learning how to ride a bike.
I think it's true.
They need the community to run along behind them and hold the seat and tell them, you can do it, buddy.
That's with new authors too. I mean, like, to be fair, so you'll see someone like, you know, look, when Karen Swallow Pryor says hashtag I'm writing, she's not looking for validation. I think she's just letting everybody know that she's writing something.
Does she say that about, though?
And she does. And so she'll have, like, I think she has like a fan. So for her, I think it's more of a, hey, just so you know, I'm working on something I'm excited about, and I hope you get excited about it too. I think it's more of an opportunity to do that. I don't imagine somebody like that would be like, oh shoot, I don't think I'm a great writer. I need your validation. I don't think
she does either.
So I have two questions on Karen Swallow Pryor. One is a question and the other is like a point to make that's related to the question. Baby, did she like or retweet or do anything with your Super Bowl tweet? Because I feel like she's in the same kind of wheelhouse there.
She is also not a sport.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she would not. I mean, she doesn't know me from Adam, so the answer was no.
Okay, yeah. So
I mean, I don't know. Maybe she did. I didn't see
it. I don't know if you guys have bonded over the anti-sporto thing at all.
Well, I mean, no. And I mean, that was an earnest pro-sporto post, boys, for the Super Bowl, man.
I don't know, man. It was a little tepid. But so here's my point, though. This is why.
No, you don't just get to say that and move on, Big T. That was not tepid. That was me saying, dude, you can be a non-sporto and literally enjoy the heck out of that game. And I did. It was awesome.
That's great.
So
that's good.
I don't know what to say. You know,
look, the fact that you said I'm not a sporto, just
yeah, the word sporto.
Can we just sit with that for a moment? Both in a
you can sit with that for the rest of your life, Pipe. You're gonna have to sit with that for the rest of your life.
I will be a sporto the rest of my life. I guess I will be sitting with it.
I actually
you will be sitting with it.
Yeah. Pipe
hashtag M sporto.
I want to make the argument that Ron actually is a sporto. And
I am. I'm just not a.
I'm gonna.
It's not a basic sport.
I'm gonna do it. Oh yeah, you're super unique. You know, interesting sporto. Definitely more. You know, way cooler than other sportos, of course. But I think you're a highly competitive person. I think you like something that I like about sports, which is at odds with the kind of hashtag am writing energy, which is sports is the ultimate truth teller, right? Like. If you're a writer, you can say, I want to write in community so I can find a bunch of people who will say that I don't suck. But like with sports.
It's subjective. Writing will always be subjective. It's not winners and losers. It's a piece of art.
With sports, you actually know if you do or don't suck. And even if like you do suck compared to super elite people, it's actually okay. Like I know I'm not as good at football as like people who are really, really good at it, but I'm better than a whole lot of other people. That doesn't mean you should quit and go home. It's just the ultimate truth teller. And I think you actually are a sporto because when you were racing, you know, dirt bikes or whatever, I mean, if you came in ninth, that means eight people were better than you and you still might've been better than 20 people, but that's where you were. And I think there's something actually about that we miss in our lives. Because we're all in really ambiguous career fields where like, it's not super apparent if you do or don't suck.
Yeah.
No, you know what I mean? Yeah. Pipe, Ron's a sporter.
Well, no, and I've always said that. I've always said that. Cause as an artist, art is always subjective. So you can't, there is no like good, bad. It's all, you know, because your good is going to be somebody's bad and
yeah.
Somebody's going to say, well, you think that's horrible, but I actually love that. So there's always going to be that argument, but nobody can argue with who won the game or won the race.
Right.
And so, yeah, I do like racing. So I'm a sporto when it comes to that. Sporto to me is always just kind of talking about the big three because that dominates the world. So I do love one particular sport that I'm pretty dedicated to.
Yeah.
And the other thing though, T, is what you don't know about me is I am an incredibly non-competitive person.
See, I disagree,
but
dude.
I do like watching other people compete.
I think you're competitive.
Well, you kind of don't get to disagree with that.
What's the difference between being a perfectionistic person and a competitive person?
Hmm. I don't know. I'm neither of those people. So I reject perfectionism. I hate that. And I'm not competitive because I don't play sports.
Okay. So, well, let me ask you a question. I mean, I think perfectionism could be defined. It could be perceived any number of ways. So when, you know, you recently released an album that is a significant achievement. A lot of artistry goes into that. I know a lot of people in the music world, songwriters, musicians, and the ones who are the best at it that I know usually reach a point not of satisfaction with their work, but like, okay, it's time to hit send on this.
Yeah.
So, in my mind, that's a level of perfectionism where they're like, but also, you know, kind of self-disciplined to say it's as good as I'm going to make it now, but they're not satisfied. So I think that's perfectionism. Do you have that mindset or when you send stuff off, are you like nailed it? That was exactly what I wanted.
Well, no, I would argue that if you knew the amount of musicians that have started things and never released them, they never even get to that first release, I would consider that to be some sort of twisted, distorted definition of perfectionism. I would say that most people that are releasing any kind of product, there's a high sense that they're not perfectionist, because it's never, you're hypercritical of your work. It technically always can be improved. You never release it at a place where you're thinking, dude, I nailed it. And again, after releasing so many different kinds of like art, I mean, I get to a place very quickly where I go, it is what it is. I want it to be a burst of inspiration that, you know, that basically embodies that time that I worked on it, and then just let it go. And, you know, I'm old now, so I'm not going to have this mourning process over it, because I could have gone back and edited it to death, because we're in an age where you can edit everything to death. It was different than it was back in the old days, especially with recording. Yeah. But yeah, I think, the people that are the actual perfectionists don't have anything to show for what they do, because they're too afraid to release it. So
it's like paralysis by perfection.
100%. Yeah. I mean, that's the way I define it a little bit more. Like guys that are just like, oh no, I'm afraid that somebody's going to, like when people say it's a brave thing for you to release what you do. And I said, well, that's going deeper than the product though. Because again, you're thinking that the product is something that defines you and identifies you. And I don't think it does. I think it's an aspect of you. And so therefore you can release it in all of its warts and be like, and I'm going to do something else. And it'll capture that other moment in time. But I don't know. I've thought so much through all this stuff, because my frustration has been working with other musicians and artists who they have some gifting and some talent, and you're trying to step with them through the process of, hey, you got to finish this. It doesn't exist if it's not finished.
Yeah.
And they never get to that place. And you guys, of course, are not, you're not in that category, because you've released a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you're not, I would argue you're not really perfectionists. Because if you could go back, you would make edits to everything you've done, because that's what everybody would do. But you don't. You're like, that's what it was.
Dude, I'm with you 100%.
And also, if you listen to this podcast, you can be pretty sure that none of us are truly perfectionists.
I mean, that's the pinnacle, right? I mean, there's no better proof of our lack of perfectionism than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So would you say, let's think of competition outside of the realm of sports. Would you say that you're a competitive person?
I am, you know, that's a great question.
Yeah.
I was kind of joking with you before.
Yeah,
I'm actually more of, I'm going to get a little vulnerable with you right now.
Yeah.
I'm actually more of an envious person.
Sure.
So I'm bothered when I see somebody do something that I feel like I could do too, or I could do a little bit better, but they've released something and they're getting some applause. And I'm like, oh man, I wish I would have done that. I can do that. I could have done it better. So I'm almost a little more influenced by, and I guess there's a competitiveness to that, but it really, to me, it forms out of almost more like envy, which is not a great thing to say on our national podcast.
No, I actually think that's really legit and really common and really relatable. And, that's why I say, I think people think of competition in this really narrow sense of like,
that's probably true.
Yeah. I get mad when I lose a sport. And then you've got all these people who are like, ah, elegant solution. I never play a sport. And yet they're ragingly competitive people. And I think envy and competition are tied pretty closely together.
But I guess what I meant by that is, and to put a final point on it is, one of those guys, like, I meet so many of these guys that it's like, well, dude, I'm so competitive. So when I come over and we play Monopoly, man, I'm just going to be so into it. I have to win. You know, when we play cards, everything I do, I have to win. I'm so competitive. Like that kind of stuff. Like, I don't care. Like, I don't care about losing a card game. I don't care about losing a bet.
See that? You know, I don't care about anything. That sounds like immaturity. And because I say that because of my own kind of trajectory, where there was a long period of my life where anything I did where there was a winner or a loser, I was mad if I wasn't the winner. And, you know, I'm not that good at everything, so I was not the winner often. And which means I just got pissed off a lot.
Yeah.
And over time, just realizing, oh, those things aren't worth the emotional investment.
Yes.
Like, and then there's some things that I just avoid. Like, I hate board games, partly because of past competitive mishaps and partly because I don't, you know, just kind of like, I don't think that's worth all the energy. But the competitive drive is still there. I just have to put it into other things.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it just goes towards like kind of measuring myself against myself.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense of like, am I doing better than I was before at the things that I have to do, whether that's writing or preaching or parenting or whatever. Mm-hmm. And not, so it's not a zero sum game, winner and loser. It's a little bit more like, you know, if somebody's in cross country or swim and they're trying to beat their own personal records constantly, there's a touch of that, but there's still a competitive drive there, just not at somebody else's expense.
I have a question.
Yeah, for, that, you might not even define that as competitiveness either. That could be something else entirely.
I have a question for both of you as men of the cloth. Are pastors competitive with each other?
Dude.
And if so, how? What does that look like? And if so, this is the three-tiered question, I guess. Like, how do we change that culture if we agree that it's not healthy? Pipe, will let you go first.
Well, first of all, they should all listen to this podcast. That's how we change the culture. Every pastor should tune in, and we will give them a good example of how not to take themselves so seriously.
That is true.
Boom.
There it is.
Yes, pastors are... It is a standout when you find a pastor who is graciously open-handed with other pastors instead of having kind of a competitive vibe.
Interesting.
So I was having this conversation with a friend the other day, and he asked me, he's a few years older than me, so mid-40s, and he just said, when you meet another guy for the first time, do you immediately size that guy up to say, could I take this guy? And I thought about it, and I thought, yes, at some level I do.
Yeah.
There's a sense of like every other man has been measured on a scale of what is my likelihood to win a fight against this guy. Mm-hmm. Like, and you could go around a room and be like, yes, no, not sure about that guy. Definitely running away from the other guy. Pastors bring the same vibe, I think, into every meeting, mm-hmm. which is why you get questions about church size and how are things going, which sound relationally kind of like
innocuous.
I'm very interested in the health of your church. And what it really is I'm really interested in how my church is doing compared to your church. Uh-huh. It's a measuring stick or a measuring contest of sorts, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it is crazy. So I wouldn't say it's antagonistic, but it's constantly low grade tension between many pastors.
That's fascinating.
That's my observation.
That's fascinating.
Ronnie, do you think that's accurate, or have you seen something different?
Go for it, baby.
No, I mean, I think, I've never once sized up a guy. I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover. So I've never looked at, that's never dawned on me to look at a guy and seeing, you know, if I can tag. I don't, my mind is just, that's not my mind. But
you're a small guy.
So maybe that's a competitive drive thing. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, we can all go reverse psychology and all this stuff, but I don't know. Again, for me, you know, one of my traits is envy. So, one of those, I'm always going to think the grass is greener for everybody else.
Sure.
And so I'm going to look at anybody's situation. And again, it can even be a situation where, we're talking about ministry, right? So I can even be sitting down with a pastor who has a church half the size of mine and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm looking at his life going, but dude, you look like you have more freedom. You look like you look like you're enjoying this a little bit more. You look like because you don't have that, you're able to do that. And then I'm envious of this guy who has a church half the size. So it's like, so that is something that just permeates like everything that I do. And it's not really based on whether you have more or less. It's just the way that I'm perceiving your life, you know, and that's why perceptions are so, you know, they're insidious, you know? And so, but I mean, to the larger point that you were saying, T, I mean, you know, it's a weird thing. I mean, I feel like we've come to this place now where we've just determined that every pastor in the world has this really fragile ego, to where, you know, even saying like what Pipe just said, like, oh no, I'm not allowed to ask you how many people go to your church. It's like, why? It's like I'm not sizing you up if I ask how big your church is. I'm just curious. It's called having a conversation. And so it's funny that we've kind of gotten into this thing, like as a way to avoid the temptation to be competitive, we almost have to like make sure that we're being sensitive. And I just go, oh my gosh, like you guys, we can talk about this. You know, we're all going to have different budgets, different sized churches. You know, it's good. It's cool. You know?
They're pretty important questions to ask when you're talking to other pastors, because it's like asking, are you married? Do you have kids?
Exactly.
How many kids do you have? What part of town do you live in? Like, it gives context for what is this person's life about? Yeah. You know, how is it shaped? And so, if a pastor's if they pastor 100-person Methodist church versus a, you know, 300-person Presbyterian church versus a 1,000-person Baptist church, really different circumstances, right. Nothing to do with competitiveness necessarily. But I think there is still that sort of like walking on eggshells tense vibe oftentimes when those questions get asked.
Or they just feel like they're not allowed to ask them. Like, Pipe, I had a guy that was like, he literally had to qualify for like, it felt like 20 minutes before he asked how big my church was. And I finally went, dude, you can ask, like, I have no, it's okay. You know, like we can chat about this, man. It's no big deal.
That's super
fun. But that's just kind of a culture thing, right? Like a younger guy. Hey, I know this doesn't really matter, and I don't want you to take this the wrong way, and I hope I'm not overstepping my bounds. And I'm like, dude, you need to ask the question.
Yeah.
Like ASAP.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a funny thing, but
interesting. Do you guys feel like pastoral ministry attracts a certain kind of competitive guy? Like, I feel like you meet two kinds of guys in pastoral ministry. You meet the guy who was like a college baseball player, or you meet the guy who is like a really super bookish nerd. And
those two extremes.
Yeah, they can both be really competitive.
But they're both very, I would say the common denominator with all, in fact, I talked about this last week, is pastors are massively insecure. Most pastors are just, they're just dripping with insecurity. And so, and again, that's the case for a book guy or a jock, you know, sure, I mean, it's just, that's going to exist.
Yeah.
Or an arty guy who's the most insecure person in the world. It's just insecurity, I think, is the common denominator.
So, who is secure? You know what I mean? Like, I mean,
nobody,
you know, on paper, and you guys will know what I'm asking with this. I'm not, trying to be aggressive or whatever, but like, on paper, a pastor should be the most secure person, because on paper, the pastor walks the most closely with the Lord and has his personhood defined by things that matter. Again, ostensibly, these are aspirational kind of statements, but like, who's secure, you know?
Yeah.
See, I think those statements you just made are precisely why pastors feel insecure. Mm.
Talk about
that. Because they feel the need to live up to walking most closely with the Lord, when in reality, I think most of us wake up every day in like, we're in a bad mood, and we don't feel any great affection for Jesus, just right out of the, like, it's just as much of a struggle to have a personal relationship with the Lord if you're a pastor as if you're anything else. So when people look at you and say, well, you walk more closely with the Lord, right? You go, No, not really.
Yeah. I'm trying.
That makes sense. It makes a lot of sense.
So I think there's, the question of who is secure is the people, anybody who has learned how to put off exterior expectations that don't actually define a person.
Yeah.
Well,
which is one of the hardest things to do in all of life, and probably an ongoing process for all of us to some degree.
But to put a point on it though, too, I mean, there's some, you know, in a lot of ways with what you do vocationally too, Big T, is, I mean, this, like, pastoring is a job that is, I mean, dude, it is just literally, you know, it's putting a knife and twisting into your insecurities all the time. Mm-hmm. There are some jobs that do that as well. And then there are many jobs and other vocations that aren't so much, that this is not the way that they're sort of like, they're framed and they're shaped. There's not as much potential for that. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, man, when you've given your life away to people, and, you know, and they have, you know, they're able to with a comment or with a phone call or a text, just sort of, you know, kind of turn your day upside down.
Yeah.
You grow a particular like level of insecurity in that, because you become hyper aware, and you know, all that leads into deeper insecurities. Not all jobs are like that, and that's okay. Yeah. It's not saying boo hoo, this is the hardest thing in the world at all. I don't ever say that. It's just saying like there's elements to what we do, and even what you do, T, because you're open to criticism more than so many other vocations are.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, that's very true. And you kind of like, you have to make your peace with it, or else you're miserable in it. You know, there's a sense of like, I'm accepting this vocation for what it is, in light of the fact that it's not the hardest thing in the world, right? Like there are myriad other things that are worse or harder or whatever. And also in light of the fact that there are aspects of it that I really like, or that ostensibly you guys really like. So, you know, you just kind of go being alive is part and parcel with being criticized and, you know, all that kind of goes together. But this reminds me, I had lunch with a guy who knows you guys, and he's kind of one of these pastor, writer, doing books types. Dean and Sarah, do you guys know this person?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know him, but I know of him.
He came and spoke at our chapel at school the other day. And
Nice.
Yeah, had lunch. So anyway.
Yeah. Did you dig it?
Yeah, Dean. Go ahead. I think Ronnie asked, did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, totally. He was a good dude. You were going to say about him, Pipe.
I was going to say we were just talking about pastors being insecure. I'm sure that at some level, Dean wrestles with that like any human, but he seems to have kind of found a comfort level of kind of, this is what I can do. This is what I can't do. This is what I'm called to. This is what I'm not called to, kind of keeps a lot of the insecure clutter out of his life.
Yeah.
Which I think makes him a much more fun person to interact with because he's just himself.
Yeah.
And then probably, I haven't been to his church, but probably makes him a much better pastor as well, because he's just not trying to be something he's not,
which
is a weakness of many pastors.
No, that's a great point. And that actually, and we should close the show soon, but there's another kind of pastoral personality type that we haven't talked about. And Dean is probably this type of person. Kevin DeYoung definitely was. Like, criticism just doesn't touch them at all.
Like bounces off him.
Kevin did not mind people coming at him for some controversial take. Whereas like, you know, if we got slaughtered in like a column or something after Why We're Not Emergent, like I wouldn't sleep for 3 days. And Kevin was just like, cool, this is fun. Kind of, you know, I'm enjoying it. And I'm just like, are you even a human being? Like, what's wrong with you? You know? But I think I see that personality type, and they are the ones to me that kind of make pastoring look easy, you know, like, I'm fine if somebody's mad at me. Like Dean is about to, I forget what the topic is. He's about to release some book that he's just going to get slaughtered for. Like he's going to get ripped to pieces. It's about like, I don't know, modesty or something. And I mean, if you're a man to begin with, you can't write about women, you know, but then like add to that the modesty topic.
And if you're a Christian, you can't write about sexuality.
Yeah.
Like, there's just, it's a minefield.
He's just going to get lit up, but he doesn't care, you know, like he's completely at peace with it. So it's fascinating to meet people like this.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, good boys, times. We've done what we always do on this program. In that we came to the table with one topic that we didn't even get to. So we can push that to next week. I don't know how we even ended up talking about the things that we talked about, but we did wander to and fro throughout them. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Hello, my name's Rachel Carmen, and I want to invite you to come over and listen to my podcast. It's called Real Refreshment. For years and years as a young mother, I chased after the wind, thinking that the world could offer me the refreshment I longed for. But it was only when I discovered it in the person of Jesus Christ that I really found refreshment. Come on over and join me as we dig into Bible study. I'll see you there.